todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. Today's guest is Eric Nelson, the director of Daytime Revolution, a new documentary that chronicles one week in 1972 when John Lennon and Yoko Ono co-hosted the most popular show on daytime TV, The Michael Douglas Show. They brought together iconic leaders of cultural, musical, and political revolution. Eric is also known for producing Grizzly Man, directed by Werner Herzog, and his own projects, such as Dreams with Sharp Teeth and an upcoming project that he's going to give us a little sneak peek at. So let's get him on the line. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast.
Delighted to be here.
Well, thank you. First of all, I want to go slightly off topic because my mom used to date Harlan Ellison, and I knew him too, so I have to compliment you on your Dreams with Sharp Teeth documentary.
Your mom survived Harlan Ellison, so congratulations.
Yeah, well, you did too. Yes, you did. Yeah, he was quite the character, and you really brought that out in such a fun and multifaceted way. I've recommended that documentary to so many people.
Oh, good. Yeah, it has its way. It does capture Harlan, and what I'm happy is that Harlan got to see it and enjoy it while he was alive. So he knew he had that cinematic legacy that would endure. It's often these things are done after the subject has passed on, but Harlan got to see it in a theater filled with people, and he knew he had that representation to continue. My last conversation with Harlan a month before he passed away was to let him know that we were restoring to widescreen. We basically remastered and restored the documentary and even added the new Nebula Award he had won to our credits, which
oh wow him. Yeah, that's great. I was working for the Sci-Fi Channel when it came out, and I got to interview him a few times about it, and that's how kind of how we reconnected. And when I mentioned that he and my mom used to be an item, he's like, oh my God, how's Nancy? You know, he was so excited. Like he was a great guy and very acerbic, as you also brought out, but very great documentary. But I want to know, like, how do you find your subjects, and what are the criteria for actually stepping in to make one? Because they're certainly not easy.
Well, they're not easy. And my track record and collaborators, because I really collaborated with Harlan Ellison in the making of that film. He had to authorize it and allow me in. I've done four films with Werner Herzog, who's not necessarily an easy collaborative subject, though in fact he actually is. And this new film, Daytime Revolution, I worked with Yoko Ono. She definitely was involved and had input rights, let's put it that way. You know, mm-hmm. I was definitely respectful of her and Sean, and I was quite happy to let them in on the process, because this was a something that Yoko had put together and masterminded, and thankfully she's still around. So it was a great opportunity to connect with the subject of the film. So to answer your questions, I guess I'd pick the most difficult and outwardly cantankerous people in the world and figure out a
No
way to work
kidding.
with them.
Oh, well, you do a great job with it, I have to say. Now, what inspired you to explore this particular John Lennon Yoko Ono angle? So what inspired you to make this into a doc?
Well, it's a sequel in a way to a film I executive produced quite some years ago called The U.S. versus John Lennon, which was about the deportation hearing when basically Richard Nixon declared war on John and tried to get him deported from the United States between 1972 and I think 1975. And these broadcasts played a pivotal role because at that time, Nixon recognized that John and Yoko had a tremendous audience, and he was worried about them using that power to disrupt the 1972 election. This 1972 election was incredibly polarized. It was Nixon's second term. He ran against George McGovern as the United States was in a process of fracturing. And in the back of my mind, I knew that the 2024 election was incoming and the United States was in a similar position. So the idea of, drilling down on those particular shows on that particular week and connecting a bridge, a time portal, if you want to use a Harlan Ellison expression, a time portal back to 1972 and allow our audience today access to the then, just seemed like a good subject for a film. And I still, 3 years later, after I started working on it, I still believe timing is everything. And our timing, where it's going to be released on October 9th, the month before this election, couldn't be better in a way. And I think the durability of John and Yoko's message, it speaks for itself.
They'd brought in a lot of super controversial figures onto daytime TV where they weren't often seen, like Jerry Rubin and Bobby Seale. How do you think that their choices for guests impacted the cultural dialogue of the time?
I don't think it Nixon won overwhelmingly that election. I think he took 49 states except for Massachusetts. So let's just say it didn't hurt Nixon's chances. And I'm not sure that it changed hearts and minds of the 40 million, mostly housewives who watched the program during on daytime television. But it is a durable work of art, and it's fascinating to see John and Yoko sitting with Mike Douglas, communicating these values, their politics, this culture, this music, even today. So if you cut out the audience and just watch it today, it still holds up. And if you're a fan of John Lennon, a fan of the Beatles, this is a real window into John Lennon. He never looked better. He never sounded better. He was never more ingratiating and seemingly happy to do it. And he's co-hosting a TV show. It's sort of fun to watch John Lennon doing something that he'd never done before. So the whole thing, I think, still has value. And I think the content of this great experiment that they put together still speaks for itself.
Well, I feel like a lot of people listening to the show, of course, are familiar with John and Yoko, but they may not know who Mike Douglas was. So, can you give us a little recap on him?
So Mike Douglas was the most popular daytime talk show host in America at the time. In New York, I think in any given afternoon, 40% of the TVs were tuned to the Mike Douglas show at the time these shows were broadcast. He was an immensely popular, affable, mainstream TV host, not the kind of guy who would welcome Bobby Seale and Jerry Rubin and Yoko Ono and Elephant's Memory and John Lennon into his virtual living room. But he did it. And he pulled it off beautifully. And again, this is an optimistic portrayal of America at a time when such radical ideas could be welcomed into America's living room. And it's somewhat sad to see kind of the deterioration and polarization of America. It's hard to imagine a more polarized America than existed in 1972, but it's hard to imagine anyone today who commanded that amount of attention pulling something like this off. And the credit goes to Mike Douglas. He did a great job. He was the third superstar that week, I think. His interviews are great. And John, who did not suffer fools, John Lennon did not suffer fools, you can see really warm up to Mike, and they really kind of connected for five straight shows, which were taped across, I think, 4 weeks.
And you also have new interviews with some of the people who were there back in the day. My favorites were Vivian Reid and Ralph Nader. Can you talk about them as well as some of the others that you were able to track down?
We made a decision not to talk to anyone and put anyone in the film who wasn't there at the time. I didn't want to have talking heads explain to people how important it was. I wanted the programs themselves to speak for themselves, and the people who were actually there on the ground speak for their experience. So Vivian Reid, who you mentioned, was a friend of Mike Douglas. She was a mainstream singer, Vegas singer, who Mike Douglas liked, who had a terrific voice, and she really had no idea what she was getting into. She was just doing a Mike Douglas show and booked and just happened to be there the week that Mike and John and Yoko did their thing. So she had a certain reaction to it. Ralph Nader was a perennial on the Mike Douglas show. And imagine a daytime talk show that would have an intellectual, semi-radical like Ralph Nader on regularly. This isn't the only appearance he made. And it's great to see Ralph is still alive and kicking and still very
Yeah.
much Ralph Nader. It was a privilege to talk to him. And if anything, I want to remind people that Ralph Nader is far more than the guy who people unfairly, I repeat, unfairly blame for George Bush winning Florida. You know, Al Gore lost that election, not Ralph Nader. But we're happy to have him in there. And we had other people around the show too. Associate producer Ernie DeMassa, who was, I think, in his early 20s at the time. He speaks to like the behind the scenes of the Douglas show, how they were reacting to everything. We have Nobuko Miyamoto, who was sang on the show, very radical Asian American, who's a radical Asian American today. She's aged wonderfully and she's still up to, has not compromised in her life and work since then. So, and Hillary Rosen, who is a 23-year-old chef at a local macrobiotic restaurant, who just sort of got drafted into doing this and had one afternoon where she cooks, does a cooking segment with John, Yoko, and Chuck Berry. So imagine that. So,
Yeah, that was amazing.
and that's, you can't imagine Yoko Ono in her wildest dreams ever coming up with something weirder than that. So, you know, sometimes reality is even weirder than surreality.
Well, I want to circle back a little bit. A question came to me sort of in relation to Mike Douglas. You would kind of think that this subject matter would be more apropos, say, on the Dick Cavett show or something like that. Do you
Which,
know
yeah, which
why?
does, which, well, you know, John and Yoko did the Dick Cavett show around the same time. And that was reaching a late night, smart New York set. You know, the Dick Cavett show really was an intellectual, erudite, was hunting different game than Mike Douglas was. So the answer is what John and Yoko did on the Douglas show would have been more suited to Dick Cavett. And in fact, they did Dick Cavett. But what's so wonderful about these shows, it's John and Yoko reaching, as I said, at 40 million. Mainstream, mostly women, TV couch potatoes. It's fascinating. And the fact that they were speaking to this entirely different audience and adjusted their message accordingly is what's so interesting. This is really them trying to communicate the strongest ideals of the 60s to an audience who traditionally wouldn't be open to this at all, which is, I think, what terrified Richard Nixon. And what led to Nixon after these shows went out saying, we've got to stop this now. What do we do? And that's when they declared war on John Lennon.
And like you say, it kind of circles back to today with the election going on. And there's also been some strife, not in the same way, I guess, with musicians and some of the political candidates. I know Jack White is currently suing Donald Trump.
As is Isaac Hayes, as is anyone who's ever had a song expropriated. Fortunately, Taylor Swift, Trump didn't pick up any of her songs, and we know where she stands now on this election. So this merging of politics, music, and television is not unique. And again, I will say I saw this coming, and I positioned the film both creatively and the timing of its release to come out precisely when it's coming out to make these connections apparent.
I really loved how you kind of zeroed in on Yoko's teacup, and I loved how you found that as sort of a foothold for us to kind of build suspense in a way.
Will she
What
finish the teacup?
she
Yeah,
did.
question.
Spoiler alert. No, but what was the significance of that, and what drew you into making that into sort of a through line for the doc?
It just seemed to work. The shows, each one of the five shows was 90 minutes in length total, crammed with guests and long, lengthy things. And because we wanted to include all five shows in chronological order in the confines of a 2-hour documentary, we had to basically reduce each show by 4/5. So certain choices had to be made of how to present the material. And that's what was very, very time consuming and difficult. And Yoko's cup really stood out as something that I found charming. Even John didn't quite know what she was up on about and says point blank to Yoko, "Now, what are you up to with this?" So it's a great moment where John Lennon is as befuddled as Mike Douglas. And that was just one of the many creative choices we made. We had to be careful about what music we used. We didn't want to overwhelm the film with music. Because we had David Rosenbaum, was another Rosenboom was another avant-garde musician who was on the show and doing a biofeedback music sequence with them all, including Chuck Berry. We obviously leaned on his segment. We had Hilary Rosen, who was in the cooking segment. So we spent more time on the segments where we had the people, because sadly, most of the guests who were we didn't include in the film have passed away. So we had that helped us make our selection process. But at the end, I hope the seams don't show and it just sort of plays out organically and doesn't feel like we're cutting anything, and there's a kind of a flow to it and an arc to it. So you sort of see them come on when they're first introduced, and then you see them get more and more comfortable. And at the end, Mike sings that corny but wonderful song, celebrating the week with John and Yoko there. And it's charming, it's innocent, it's provocative all at the same time.
Well, you mentioned the music, and music documentaries can be especially difficult to make because of the rights. But I know you worked with Yoko on this, so was that an issue with
Not
Daytime
really, no. One of
Revolution?
the reasons we worked with Yoko, we had their blessing, so we were able to use the music. We cleared the music. We were able to afford to clear the music, which, Beatles songs in movies can, I think Mad Men spent $250,000 just to use the master of Tomorrow Never Knows. Think about that. Because this film was a loving and realistic portrayal of what happened. I know for a fact Yoko and John, seem to really like it. I don't know if they love it, but they certainly really like it. And the proof's in the pudding. They let us use the material.
Now, I want to ask you about the themes discussed, because there are some fun, light-hearted moments, but also in 1972 there was police violence, issues with women's liberation, political activism. These things still do resonate today, and I know that you timed this film to come out in an election year as well. But what do you hope that modern audiences will take away from Daytime Revolution?
Well, I think the end of the film, we let the people again speak for themselves, but a message of optimism. John's very clear. Change starts from you. Don't give up. Fight the fight. And the values that they espoused 50 years ago hold up today. There's nothing they were saying then that we shouldn't take on board now. Bobby Seale's message of, we got to feed people first, take care of them, house them first, and then we can talk about anything else. That works for me. Jerry Rubin was very, on the class disparity and the grinding treadmill that killed his father. Mike gets right there where you find where Jerry Rubin was coming from, where he said, "The system killed my father." I think those are issues today. So Nabucco basically saying that Asian Americans are discriminated against. Immigrants have been discriminated against in America. Well, really, has anybody been to Springfield, Ohio lately? So all of the messages are there, and this is a political film. I'm an unashamed blue state lefty radical. Have no qualms about that. And if people don't like the political message, don't watch the movie.
Well, people will want to watch it, and I'm wondering if you can let us know. You'd mentioned that it's coming out in October. How can they watch it and
Well,
where?
it'll be out October 9th at a theater near you. So it's out. The title of the film is Daytime Revolution. Right, it's in definitely coming out in theaters for one night on John Lennon's 84th birthday, what would have been his 84th birthday, and it may go longer then. It'll be out on home video eventually. I'm sure it'll be on a streaming channel. It's going to have its way in the culture. But right now we're focused on the theatrical, a chance to see it in the dark with your fellow Americans and watch John and Yoko speak from the past to our present. That is best done live. It's best done on John's birthday, and everyone will have a chance to do it on October 9th.
It's a fantastic way to celebrate him and Yoko and the message. I want to skip ahead just a little bit because I was curious to know about one of your next projects, which is also music related.
I have a project that's set in the month of the musical Renaissance. The Renaissance of the Renaissance was May of 1966 in a 100-mile square radius of London. And in that one month in May of 66, the Beatles are recording Revolver, which some many argue is their best record. They're making that record. Bob Dylan is in town playing the final apocalyptic shows with the band, the electric shows that were featured. Scorsese's No Direction Home. Stanley Kubrick is in principal photography in London of 2001, A Space Odyssey. Muhammad Ali fights a heavyweight fight in London that month. Cream gets together, and all five members of Monty Python work together for the first time on The David Frost Show. So one could argue the greatest music, the greatest comedy, the greatest fighter, the greatest movie are all being made in London that one month. So I want to do a project that focuses on that renaissance of the renaissance. And no one has connected those dots before. I'm the guy. No one's said, wait a minute, all of this is happening at the same time. But it is. So I think that that's a interesting project, and I'm trying to figure out how to get somebody to allow me to make it.
I love that. I will definitely tune in for that one as well. I'm a big fan of your work, so I'm happy to see you working, excited about your next project and this amazing documentary about John and Yoko's daytime revolution. So where can fans find and follow you on social media?
They can't. I'm pretty careful about
You are.
scrubbing. I sweep out my footsteps. I do have a carefully curated Facebook account. My company does have a website, though. So if you go
Yes.
on the Google and search for creative differences, and maybe punch in my name, Erik, our website will come up, and there's a lot of stuff there
Oh, good.
to look at. So. Not social media, but we do have a carefully maintained website that lists our different projects and interesting things about them and reviews. So that's where you can find more stuff on our work.
Well, thank you, Eric. I really appreciate your time and congratulations on an excellent new project.
Thank you. Delighted to talk to you.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's ROCK-N-ROLL-Nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening. Well, she's by